Pekka Tovri. Welcome, Pekka.
Thank you, thank you.
I called upon you a few days ago because we had such momentous days and they don't seem to be ending. Last week, Friday evening, everybody prepared for a long weekend. There were a couple of rumors, maybe something going on in Kherson, that maybe this, that, and the other. And then the Kerch Bridge went boom. And right after that, and all the extreme amount of attention for that, the Russian forces converted what they had prepared for since October 2 or 3, depending on who you ask and what we look at, meaning missile attacks, rather indiscriminate, and none of them directed at military targets, albeit that a number of strategic civil infrastructure, electricity and the likes were hit. I thought, who else other than you, Nick Ryan and Ben Hodges to call upon? And in this instance, I think with Nick Ryan having recommended that we should really talk to you about it, I thought we cannot miss that opportunity. What do you make of this situation? And maybe a little bit later, we can talk about the strategic aspects of the Ramstein meeting today. But what do you make of the situation and the response of the Kremlin?
Well, I'd say that first of all, the Ukrainians always seem to be able to surprise us with their cunning and great capability to create operational surprises. Surprises which humiliate Russians, but also create operational effects. And this is a perfect example. Right after Putin's birthday, you blow up his bridge. And same time, cause a lot of hiccups and problems for Russian logistics, especially in the Kherson direction. So it was a brilliant move, especially considering how much effort Russians have put on protecting the bridge. You know, even more or less advertising it on social media, how deeply layered defensive they have around the bridge so that the Russian Ukrainians couldn't touch it, and then making hit like that, at least dropping the capacity of the bridge considerably for a longer period of time. And Russian reaction, well, that's pretty normal, I'd say. We've seen it before when they are beaten by the Ukrainians. They answer, you know, they can't fight the Ukrainian military, so they do what they can and hit the civilian targets. And knowing that the Russian targeting process is not agile enough, it's not capable enough to target especially mobile military targets, you know, the power stations and hospitals can't run away, so it's easier to hit the civilian targets and then revenge the success that the Ukrainians have managed to gain to the civilian population.
What does that mean for the strategic picture? How does it impact the planning on both sides at the moment? That the Ukrainian armed forces have evidenced yet again that there's not a single space in what is currently occupied Ukraine they cannot touch?
Well, I think that as we've seen, it has created a lot of fear and even panic among the Russian population in Crimea. And then when they see that again, yet again, Ukrainians are able to hit Crimea over long distances, so it's not a safe haven for themselves, and it also creates a lot of problems for the Russian military, because protecting the lines of communication in these occupied areas, it's a demanding task. And once again, Ukrainians show that there's not a place they couldn't hit. Means that they have to put more effort in protecting these lines of communications if they want to keep their forces on the front lines supplied. So it doesn't make it any easier for the Russian general staff and the new commanding general commanding the operation.
The logistics side has been highlighted by various parties already. And in a discussion with General Ryan, we focused on this a few weeks ago already. But it has become evident that the supplies of both small arms as well as munitions as well as ordnance for the Kherson, how do we call this now? It's not a single pocket. It's a whole salient they need to supply for. That supply line is now been throttled. The supply from the east, from Rostov-on-Don through Melitopol and onwards, is pre-sited and at risk. How do you see the logistics challenge the Russian armed forces are facing in the south and southeast?
Well, I think that, yes, they are really scratching their heads, I suppose, because we've seen, for example, that in Donbas, the Russians have been, they don't can't trust the communication lines through Luhansk anymore, and they're rerouting the supplies going further to the east along the Russian area, down south, and they used to use the rail lines to Crimea, you know, coming from east, going to Crimea, then up north, directly to Kherson, which is easier to protect. Even though it's a bit longer line, but now if they have to start moving material along the southern coastline, you know, through Melitopol to Kherson, well, that starts to be in the range of HIMARS rockets, and if that the Ukrainians have shown that they are operating in the area, they have partisan movement and special operational forces operating there, and they have hit the railroad transportation already a couple of times. So that means that instead of secure lines of communications to support the fighting in Kherson, you have to now take them in a much more vulnerable route and put much more effort in protecting those lines of communications. And you are totally on a reactive mode. You know, the Ukrainians dictate the fight because they hit freely, and the Russians try to predict that and try to prevent these attacks.
It is interesting. I started comparing this fight to the rumble in the jungle, where Muhammad Ali actually was able to take a lot of punches, heavy punches, and wore out Frazier. But whenever necessary, he was able to still dance, and he was able to still hit the other side hard and with very, very focused punches. It seems that General Zaluzhny and his staff have managed to preserve their capacity to strike at will and where necessary. General Hodges and Ryan both came to the conclusion, I think, which is quite consistent with what you said the last time when we spoke, that they are hitting, the Ukrainians are hitting the Russians where they're not. They go as far as to break them there because the Russian side is thinned out. This thinning seems to continue both in the southeast as well as in the eastern side, meaning in Luhansk Oblast. Can you speak to that? Is that the relevant strategy they're applying?
Well, I'd say that it's pretty difficult to guess
what the Ukrainian strategy
in this fight, because obviously I'd say that Ukrainians are a bit in the same situation like George Washington was during the independence war in the United States. His most important thing wasn't to win, but not to lose. As long as you had the Continental Army up and running, the fight was going on, and Washington knew that sooner or later Brits will have enough and they will give up, which then happened, of course, with support of France and some other military efforts. But still, you know, to war out the big enemy, not give him a chance to crush you, keep, you know, protect your fighting force so that you have a force that we can fight and can conduct these surprise attacks, be on offensive, and slowly but surely, yes, war out the enemy and take back your lands.
This war of attrition, General Zeluzhny in his article as well as in the interviews thereafter, has indicated this as well, that they've been destroying, quite literally, destroying the regular Russian army, and now they're destroying whatever else comes. The attrition level, what we heard, the numbers today, even what has now been confirmed by Russian sources, to the extent that it can be believed, exceeds 90,000. How long is that tolerable for the Russians?
Well, that's a good question. I think there's a big change happening now, that because up till now, the war has been more or less something that hasn't touched too many of the Russians. You know, it's something that's been fought by the contract soldiers, the professional military, Wagner mercenaries, whatnot. And you know, last summer in St. Petersburg and Moscow, it was party. Didn't touch a normal Russian. Yes, there were big losses, but didn't seem to move too much. Especially Mr. Putin couldn't care less about their losses. But now that we have this mobilization, we've seen the first wave. I'm pretty sure that we're going to see more waves coming in, and they're going to mobilize more forces. Now it starts to hit normal Russian families, even though they put emphasis still on the more remote areas down south and far east, and St. Petersburg and Moscow and other Russian cities are not hit as much, but still even they start to get affected. And it's now it's the normal people, normal reservists, fathers, sons, brothers, and the only fact we know is that they're gonna see a lot of losses. I'd say that overall the Russian preparation for this war has been surprisingly sloppy. Everything has done too late, whether it's the mobilization of the forces, if the mobilization of the industry, etc. Now, first time they at least do something which makes sense, that they have started to mobilize their medical services. You know, they are recruiting and mobilizing nurses and doctors from the civilian side, and are preparing to handle mass casualties. And that's what they're going to face when they throw in these badly trained, badly equipped, badly led and badly motivated reservists to fight with the seasoned, experienced, motivated Ukrainian forces. And that, in some point, might start to have an effect in how the Russians view the war. Now it starts to touch everybody. Is it enough to tip the scale so much that that population would start to we would diminish the support to Putin and start actually active resistance, remains to be seen, because Russians really don't have that experience. You know, the people has never changed the leadership in that country. But on the other hand, we've seen, you know, what the Afghan war did, with much less losses, with much longer time period, and still caused a lot of unrest in the society, and forced the political leadership make some changes, or how the mothers of the conscripts have during the Chechenian wars managed to create a movement that the political leadership have to take into account. So remains to be seen if that's going to happen now.
Well, the last time the Russian army lost 50,000 men in a few days was in Kursk.
Yeah.
Do you think that the Ukrainian army in the field can attrit the Russians now in Kherson, Crimea, in the southeast, and in Lugansk to that extent that, in, let's say, even if it takes 3 months, that they actually destroy as many Russians being thrown at the front in that format? Is that a likely outcome?
Well, not necessary. You know, the Russians are now in defense. They are building. You know, they are digging trenches. They are laying minefields. They are clearly on defense. They still have a lot of artillery still have a lot of direct firepower, and in many areas the terrain really don't favor an attacker offensive, unless you don't, especially if you don't have a lot of armor, which the Ukrainians don't have. So I don't you know, there's a there's in Kherson, yes, we have the 20 plus something Russian badly depleted battalion task forces, which are on that pocket, and within a month they probably be thrown out from there, and they will lose at least majority of the equipment. Do they lose majority of the soldiers? Remains to be seen. We've seen that the Russians have been pretty good in still withdrawing. We saw it in Izium, we saw in Luman that when the Ukrainians were about to encircle the forces, the Russians pulled back, losing a lot of material, but never lost, you know, 10 battalions in one hit. They were able to withdraw and continue fighting.
Why, of course, Kherson is a difficult because. Is that a lack of armor on the Ukrainian side, so as to not to be able to push forward in pincer movements, encircle, and then force the other side? Or what? Why are these encirclements not yet resulting in what we would call a proper cauldron with applicable destructions and mass surrenders? What's missing for the Ukrainian side to do that?
Well, it's probably a lack of firepower. Whether it's armor, whether it's artillery, you know, maybe the Ukrainians tried to avoid the mistake we did in the Winter War. You know, during the Winter War, Finnish forces were able to encircle a number of Russian divisions, half a dozen, north of Lake Ladoga and further up north, and several of those units. Because we're able to sustain themselves and stay encircled all the way till the end of the war. You know, they were too heavily equipped. They had too much firepower for the Finnish light infantry troops to crush those mottis, as we call those encircled forces, especially since the Finnish artillery was too weak to support any attack. So it was a slow grinding, fighting, trying to destroy these encircled forces, and it tied up a lot of forces, and maybe the Ukrainians left some room to maneuver, you know, left open some corridors for the Russians to withdraw, so that they, you know, they left a lot of their equipment, a lot of ammunition, and let them through, causing casualties while to the withdrawing Russian forces, but avoiding the fact that you have an encircled force with heavy firepower, which will fight to the end, and you will lose a lot of your manpower, and it will tie up a lot of your forces trying to crush these encircled forces. Either or, hard to say. I'm sure that there will be very interesting books and studies about these fights after the war.
So the evident lack of firepower, I would subscribe to as well. I'm not nearly as close to this as you are in terms of analysis, but evidently there is a lack of close air support. There is a lack of proper multi-role fighters and attack helicopters, which could actually finish the job and support this. And there definitely is a massive lack of proper Western tanks, which can cut through these lines as through butter. Evidently, that is an issue. We also have heard now many times, and I think that supports what you've said, is that the Ukrainian armed forces simply do not have enough firepower amongst the advancing troops with the IFVs, and that this is a significant lack in order to close the gap to the enemy and then dissect them.
And you have to remember that armored combat is quite resource heavy, and you know, having great tanks is just a start. You know, you need mechanized infantry, you need artillery, you need the armored engineers, you need bridging capability, you need air defense, you need robust logistics, and it's a big machine, and creating that takes time. skillfully handling it takes time. And again, you'll need a lot of other capabilities. The tank itself is not an answer.
Of course. No, completely agreed with you. Now, the question is, what would you expect? Now, on the other hand, so we've now discussed that, so what our friends are doing and what kind of obstacles they are facing in the battlefield, strategic and in terms of equipment. But on the other hand, the Ukrainian society faces those terror bombings. And everybody, including Reznikov, has said in advance of the meetings today in Ramstein that the focus on the Ukrainian side is currently on air defense assets and being supplied the right air defense asset. How do you see the response of the Ukrainians and their strategic picture vis-a-vis those terror bombings, whilst the Russians are running out of precision-guided ammunition, of course?
Well, I'd say that you can see two things, couple things. I think which is admirable is first of all the Ukrainian air defenses. They have few resources, a lot of older equipment, but they still managed to down a big part of the missiles that the Russians are shooting at them. Another thing is that they civil defense organizations that they can. Even though Russians obviously timed the first attack on 10th early morning, trying to hit the morning rush, killing as many civilians as possible, the Ukrainians were able to give the adequate warning so that people could take shelter, and the human losses were much less than Russians probably hoped. So they are pretty good in warning and protecting their population. And the third is that they are very capable of repairing the damage that the Russians have managed to cause. They act very fast and get the electricity back, fix the roads, etc. in very fast fashion. So the Russian effects of those Russian attacks are pretty small. And the fact is that what we saw on 10th, they shoot about 80 missiles and used some couple dozen of those Iranians loitering weapons. Next day it was what 20, 30, and today not too many. So it just shows that Russians are running out of more capable precision engagement weapon systems that they could shoot to different several hundred kilometers. And after a couple of months of break, they could arrange this 2 days show more or less. And now they have to again concentrate their forces, try to rebuild the capability. Yeah, and what's the effect to the Ukrainian society? Quite minimal. What was the effect to the fighting capability of the Ukrainian armed forces? Zero. What was the effect on the Western community? Much stronger support again, you know, a good reminder for Western community that Ukraine needs help, and Ukraine got a lot of promises for further support to protect its population. So wasn't that great success to Russia, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, terror campaigns don't work anymore. Now, the question is, what do we expect as an outcome of today's Ramstein, as the commitments are now coming in? A couple of rumors abounded. Germany evidently just reconfirmed what it had already indicated, albeit that there is the secondary part, not just the additional Mars, which had been promised before, but more Panzerhaubitze 2000. The French came up with more systems. What do we actually really expect from today? Is that today the culmination point of, say, Western procrastination? Do we see more commitments? Will the Europeans stand up? What do you see? What do you think?
Well, good question. Very good question. I really don't know. I hope that it's a new start, more or less. That Western countries understand that they should drop any reservations and limitations they have on supporting Ukraine with weaponry, and they should also look into the giving more more of the, you know, as we've seen, the big problem is that the defense industry can't provide material too fast, especially in the most developed systems. It will take years to provide support that Ukraine needs. So the Western armies and armed forces should look to their own depots and basically take equipment that the forces have in operational use, give that to Ukraine, and then replace them from the industry in 1-2 years, whatever. Because thing is, you know, the threat in Europe is Russia, and Russian armed forces are fighting in Ukraine, and they're tied up there. So the risk, if you give up some of your operational capability to Ukraine, are pretty small. On the contrary, the equipment is could use and will further eat the Russian offensive capabilities.
Now, given the fact that you've been in this function, you've been last military intelligence for quite some time, and had a long career in the military service and seen a lot of politicians. Your own government has been supporting Ukraine substantially, but didn't talk about it. Others have talked and have not really provided substantial support, albeit that, yes, even my countrymen in Germany have provided support. And yes, there is significant assets. And yes, the cost of the IRIS is designed for. But it always seems that we have to literally drag support from them. How do you see the interaction between the militaries in Europe and the politicians, and the fact that the politicians seemingly, not all of them, have caught up? What is so different between us and the Americans, where essentially the military has a significantly higher level of trust and commitment, seemingly, from their politicians? Is that the main reason in Europe, or how would you see that?
Well, I'd say that the United States and Americans have a much longer tradition in this discussion dialogue between military and politicians, mainly because quite often during the last 20, 30 years, you know, the U.S. Political aims have been supported with military operations, whether it's operations in Iraq or in Afghanistan, or wherever. And quite often the Americans very, very, very much look in the military to find the solutions to the problems, because it's the most capable, most best funded and best supported organization the U.S. government has available. You know, they could use, when you look back to the history of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, they could have used much more State Department resources, but State Department don't have those resources, so it ended up military trying giving the task. So they have this dialogue, they are used to use it, and they have American politicians have a high trust on the military, because the military has always been loyal and they have always done what they asked to do, or at least try to do what they are and what they have been asked to do, even when the odds haven't been that good. And I don't think that we have that in Europe, that the relationship between military and political leadership is not that close in most countries. Which is a bit shame, because that dialogue would be instrumental in getting the politicians to understand what could be done more and what would make sense more. You know, the whole discussion about Germany give armor to Ukraine is a bit silly for a military standpoint. And if the chancellor would talk with his military leaders, maybe he could understand that, well, this is actually a bit silly way of seeing how to support Ukraine.
It's interesting that obviously also the leadership in the German armed forces is a politically selected one. Maybe that is also one aspect which has a different impact. If the trust has not been there, and the structure of how to create meritorious military vis-a-vis a task which is predefined, as the Americans tend to do, that seemingly is not the case in certain Western armies. I'm not trying to cast a spell on the French, who have a completely different view on these matters, or our British friends, who definitely command one of the expeditionary armies in the world, and therefore, while smaller and reduced in size, and I'm very thankful to Ben Wallace having elevated the necessity for deterrence in Britain, because without his engagement, not only would Ukraine probably look differently, but also the British forces would probably not stand a chance in future of raising their budget again after having been reduced in size for many years.
Yeah, but the fact is that Ukraine is a perfect example of what happens when the political leadership and the military leaders don't talk with each other honestly and there's no dialogue. Because, the most important thing for political leader is to give a task to the military force which is achievable. You know, it's within the resources, it makes sense, and it's the best way to support the national interest and talk with the military, what military could do to support support the efforts to reach the political need, political aims that the government happens to have. Sometimes it works, when the United States freed Kuwait in 1991 in the Persian Gulf War, the military told honestly what they needed, the politicians provided, and then it was easy task to do what the politicians wanted to happen. In 2003 in Iraq, it failed miserably. The politicians didn't, American politicians didn't listen to military, which said that, with these forces, these resources, we can take the country, but we can't keep it. And that happened. Mr. Putin has shown that what happens when a politician with no military training at all decides what's going to happen and the military leadership is afraid to tell what's actually possible and if it's not, and don't question the tasking given to them. And you start a war with far too small resources, with bad plan, and now you've been fighting 8 months, is ongoing, and still the military leadership obviously can dare to tell him that we need, we need 2-3 month break to rebuild our forces in order to do something useful. No, they just hang on and try to change the tire in a moving car, which is never easy. Luckily.
Yes, that's a good point. And thank you for that. Yeah, I think this is the perfect contrast between the authoritarian system, which has utterly no structure and no capacity to change its way at this point in time because it is too late. It is in a dead end on a wrong track. Now, even if Western Europe has been on wrong tracks, have we done enough now? Have we the opportunity and the chance to convince our political community, the population, the bureaucrats, to take this seriously? Is Europe on the right track as a consequence of this war?
Well, I'd say that we are on the right track because we are taking actions to support Ukraine and resist Russia and beef up our own defenses. But it's all happening, in my opinion, too slow and too little, and we would need to have a strategy where we plan to crush the Russian economy. The sanctions should be much harder. I understand that there's a need to protect your own economy too, but we would need to hit the Russians much harder. We should hunt down those parties who try to help Russia to go around the sanctions, give them the materials that they need. And going around the sanctions, we should need to support Ukraine more so that the armed forces would have the capabilities, all the capabilities they need to throw the Russians out. And the faster we do it, the less people die. And yes, then we would also need to tell the Russian Mr. Putin and especially people around him that if he's stupid enough to use the nuclear weapon, the consequences will be terrible to Russia.
So more solid, faster, and comprehensive deeds, and clearer, stronger words.
Yes, yes. You know, when if Russian hackers are attacking web pages of airports in the United States, well, it's, you know, it's not a big problem because they couldn't affect the air traffic too much. It's more or less a nuisance, but that shouldn't, things like that shouldn't be left go. It would be, should be punished. You know, stop any flight operations in Moscow International Airport for a couple of days. I'm saying this is just the first taste what's going to happen if you don't control these idiots.
That's a very good point. I like this concept of solid deterrence and the concept or the approach of the disproportional response. If they hit us a little, we hit them hard. If they try it again, we hit them harder.
Yeah, because unfortunately, that's the only language that Mr. Putin and people around him understand. You know, saying please is a waste of everybody's time. It has no effect. Giving a warning, a verbal warning, is a waste of time. They don't listen. But make something that makes them flinch, makes them hurt, that they will listen.
If you were the advisor today to your colleagues in the German military as to how to convince their Bundeskanzler to both give the third-party export license release and support Ukraine fully, what would you tell your colleagues in the German military?
I really don't believe that I have anything in my back pocket that would help. You know, the Chancellor, I'm 110% sure that he understands what kind of war Putin is running in Ukraine, what kind of atrocities they are doing, what kind of war crimes they are doing all the time. And I'm sure that he's been told what's needed to do, be done, to kick the Russians out of Ukraine. Change his mind. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that the Bundeswehr leadership knows their chancellor much better than I do, and they know how to try to tackle this topic. I would just, you know, and I hope that they emphasize the facts of what happens if we lose here, you know, and that's the thing we should think all the time. If Putin gets anything out of this, anything, a little bit more land, anything he can declare win, it will just convince him that I'm on the right track and I should continue. And this freaking conflict will renew itself very soon, if not in Ukraine, somewhere else. And we can't afford to have that. We have more important things to do than fighting, you know, fighting Putin all the time for the next 2-3 decades or his successor. We should end it now.
I like it when you summarize what we all here in this space have been advocating for such a long time, but you find the right words. There's no time to waste. There's more important things to do for humankind and for Europe and America together. Yeah. There's more innovations to be brought to the table, and we have different issues to tackle. We cannot afford for medieval soul in a 20th century battle mind to persecute Europe.
Exactly.
All right. So how do you see our American friends then? They have done tremendous things, despite some wobbling here and there, and of course their internal political messaging. But it seems that no matter what happens in view of the current political discussion, the fight over the midterms and whatnot, and the fringes left and fringes right, it seems that our American friends, yet again, for the third time in a little over 110 years, are doing the right thing, and they do it out of the middle of their society with a significant commitment. Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter. There is substantial support in America for the fight of freedom and for Ukraine. How do you rate what the leaders of the free world are doing?
Yeah, I have to admire the Americans and their patience. If I would be in their positions, I would start to be a bit annoyed. You know, how many times we have to come back? Can't you guys freaking grow up and start taking care of your own business? Because the fact is that we, the Western Europe, we Western countries, we have enough resources to tackle even Putin if we just put them together and think what we are doing. So, yes, they provide what 70% of the material support to Ukraine coming from the States. I'd say I would give them A minus. A plus would require that they would give them, you know, the weapon systems that the Ukrainians want to have, like ATACMS.
ATACMS, yeah. Our wonderful TACMs, the weapon of choice of Ben Hodges and mine.
and would start training, would have started training 6 months ago, F-16 pilots from Ukrainian Air Force, and, you know, sending these messages that we are really, you know, the gloves are off. We are really giving Ukrainian everything they want. And in 6 months' time, you guys don't even know what's going to hit you, because we are going to support them all the way. That would give it a plus. Now, having these, again, bit silly restrictions, not trusting Ukrainians to use the weapon systems in the right way, and not giving them the really capabilities they would need, like better Air Force capabilities and longer precision engagement capabilities. I don't understand why that's still there.
Can I
jump in? No, you can't. Kirsi, please. The policy here is as follows. We'll do the interview, then at some point in time, we're very happy to invite our guests and the community, and then we elevate you up if you raise your hand, such as Miko and Abdullah and others have done. So, for a moment, Pekka, and I apologize for the interruption. That happens from time to time with people who have not been here too much, as seemingly she wasn't. Now, the key thing, it seems there is still a little disconnect between both the administration or different parts of the administration and the Department of Defense. We've heard now many times, both directly and then through the grapevine, that the DOD would be very, very keen to actually do exactly what you just said, deliver more IFVs, release even if need be in order to convince the Germans to release the third-party export license, even release tanks for that matter, provide the supply train for it even. And, of course, not just train pilots, as seemingly may have happened, but also release multi-role aircraft. But there seems to be hesitation still in the White House, and there may be reasons for this which are way beyond my pay grade. And you just said A minus to A plus, this is the difference. What do we expect to happen in the next 3 months based on what we've seen now? The midterms are about to be over. Then there is a lame duck Congress up until January. But the administration has the lend lease. It has the capacity. It seems that President Biden is actually quite convinced that this needs to be prosecuted, that there is a moral imperative. So all the things, all the stipulations you and I and others would probably easily sign up for, he seems to be keen on it. Do you think that the Americans will intensify their efforts before the year end?
Well, I think that the Biden administration tries to do what they can do as fast as they can, knowing that in the next year there might be some political challenges providing the support in the same level. But I don't think that even if the Republicans are doing well in elections, I don't think that it will mean the end of the support to Ukraine. There might be some limitations, it might slow down, but I think the majority, as you said previously, majority of the Republicans support the idea of supporting Ukraine also in the future.
Yep, I tend to agree. Thank you for that. If you don't mind, we have lots and lots of hands up, and I would like to give people the possibility to ask you a few questions if you have the time for it. If you don't mind, Craig. Yes. Craig, could you? My fellow co-host has his hand up. Okay, he evidently can't speak, so we'll just go on to Mikko, one of your Finnish compatriots.
Yes, thanks Axel and thanks Pekka. I'm a little worried about in Finnish side, so I just received a recommendation that I need to get iodine tablets called Jodi tablets for Finnish for population. And this is official stuff. There are tablets which will protect you against the radiation. And this kind of stuff was sent, with our ministry. And I'm a little bit confused, to be honest. Did you guys in the military intelligence provide this kind of stuff? Pekka to you.
Well, I'd say that first of all, I'm not service anymore, so I don't know what the defense intelligence have told, but I'm 100% sure still that they haven't said to the other civilian ministries that we have to prepare for nuclear fallout. No, it's, you have to remember that this is old recommendation 20 years back that it would be good to households to have like you should have the food and drink for 72 hours. All the time in your household, it's the same kind of, and they emphasized in the messaging that well, there's no threat of any nuclear conflict. There's even if Saboritsa nuclear power plant blows up, still there's no danger in Finland, etc. But I'd say a bit bad timing on this recommendation, considering the times we are living in. But no, I don't see any heightened threat of Russia using its nuclear weapons, except the rhetoric from Moscow, but that doesn't mean anything at this point.
Yeah, but Pekka, to be honest, I saw it from STM, Social and Healthcare Ministry, get ionoid tablets, and now all tablets are gone.
Yeah.
You saw that.
Yeah, it's a bit, as I said, bit bad planning.
Exactly. I'm with you on that. So I don't like it.
Yeah.
We're back to the point of communication at the right time and the right form, right? But Craig, you're back.
Yes, I'm sorry. I just had to talk to somebody really quickly. So I had a question for you, sir, that I think goes beyond the battlefield and the numbers and what we're seeing in terms of the winter and try to examine these two bodies, right? Actually, you're hot milk. I can hear you.
1 second.
Yep. So I think it helps to try to look at these two systems, right? Why one is succeeding and one is failing, right? On one hand, you have the Ukrainian system, which has, I don't want to say encompassed a more Western style philosophy, but it's certainly learned to innovate and be creative when it needs to be, and then to evolve and then become something else, right? That speaks to a certain mindset. And I think you can, as a former head of intelligence, you understand that examining cultures, both within a small group, but within a large group. How do those two things work together, right? And so understanding the culture of what Russia is, I've always tried to describe it in simple terms as a body, right? It's just a singular body that can't evolve or change or adapt. And so the best way to go about undermining it is to not, I don't want to say use small little things, but try to create conflict within that structure that's created. Because the way I'm going with this is that the West has seemingly I guess you might consider it a fault that we're so individualistic that Russia seeks to exploit that by dividing us, right? Yeah. Well, what can we do to Russia? Here's the question. what is Russia's weak point in that culture of not being able to react to, say, something like what Ukraine is doing, right? That's the kind of thrust. If we could think more intellectually along those lines, I think that might help clarify what we might see over the next 6 months or more.
I'd say that the challenge we have with Russia currently is that even though his position has been weakened somewhat, Putin's position, he's still totally in control. Yes, the hit on the bridge was the first time that there was some slight blame going towards Mr. Putin, but still he's totally in control. And this internal fight which is going on between Prigozhin and military and so on, it's pretty normal. That's actually how Putin has ruled so long, that he has these different people around him who fight each other or are competing in place in the sun and are seeing the others more threat. So having the power balance. So he's in control. The Russian people themselves, as we said previously, the people, the population have never changed, practically never changed the leadership in Russia. The October Revolution wasn't a big mass revolution. It was a palace coup conducted by a couple thousand Bolsheviks. And now the population, they don't have any leaders. All the opposition leaders are in a jail or they are gone abroad. Majority of those people who don't like the government, who are capable of thinking themselves independently and can see the suffering of Ukraine, they have left the country. And the majority of the population in Ukraine, in Russia, they are more or less trying to adapt the changing situation. They are not going. They are not going to go to barricades because they know that the security apparatus against them is too heavy, and they will be dealt very very heavy-handed if they try to make a revolt or demonstration or anything. So they are just accepting their fate. Okay, I got the mobilization order. Well, I try to run away from it. I might try to bribe myself out of it. Or then I just said, okay, let's go in and hope for the best. I suppose it's the right thing to do. But going and fighting against it, no, that's not in their nature. And there was, I just talked this week with one interesting Russian person who mentioned that he's been looking at the book selling in St. Petersburg and Moscow. And he noticed that in the beginning of the attack in February, March, there's a lot of books were sold about psychology and how to relieve stress and so on. And he said now there's a lot of books bought about how it was to live in 1930s Germany, how to survive as an individual in a dictatorship. So like the more and more Russians are seeing that, well, where this is heading to, it's going to go worse. It's becoming more and more dictatorship-like, and you just have to adapt and try to survive, but you are not probably going to fight it. So if we want to influence Russia, I say that we need to try to influence the people around Putin because they are the only people who can change the ruler. The palace coup has always been is the most common way to change the ruler in Russia. So make their life so intolerable, make them to understand that the only way for them to survive is to change the leadership.
That's a very good point. Thank you very much. Let's go to Antti.
Thank you. Welcome back, sir. It's always a pleasure to see you here on the space. So I've heard a number of commentators describe Putin's decision making as endless procrastination and doing only bad decisions when there are no good options left anymore. Would you agree with that assessment? And if so, wouldn't it be in Ukraine's and indeed our best interest that Putin continues to exert command over over even minute military matters until Ukraine brings this war into to a successful close.
But I agree on the fact that yeah he don't like to make decisions which are uncomfortable. I understand that, for example, the decision about mobilization had been moved several times, mainly because there are a lot of people, especially on the economic side, who said that this is bad for Russia. So he pushed it forward till he, and then he conducted it in a little bit watered down way. So yes, but I don't think that he's, you know, Hitler was such a dictator that he screwed Germany and Wehrmacht's fight totally. I don't think that Putin is there yet. Maybe you know he's following the footpath of Hitler. He's doing more and more the same moves and same mistakes that Hitler is doing. So in this rate, yes, in year or two he might be in the same point, but not yet. I don't think so. And the thing is that you know there are about a dozen people around Putin who might be his successors. Out of those, two are as Americans say, batshit crazy. Everybody else is more moderate and more willing to make a peace, make a deal with West, get rid of this troubles they are in. So I would still try to get rid of Putin first, because Putin is the man who has a dream. He has his dream about building an empire again, Soviet Union 2.0, which means that he needs to acquire more land, even though he don't have money to develop that land anymore, but he wants more land and he hasn't given up that.
When you just said batshit crazy, how do you rate Mr. Sechin and Patrushev?
Well, I'd say that Patrushev goes right to that to that range. The other gentleman, I'm not 100% sure. I don't know about him enough. And then, of course, we have guys like Prigozhin, old criminal, hanging around. But I don't think that he's in a position to. But he hopes to be in a position to compete, but I don't think that he is.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And one can only hope that Mr. Patrushev never gets the keys to anything. If you don't mind, I would go on to further hands. We have Katik, and then afterwards Abdullah, then M, Nina, and Miko. So, Katik.
I think Abdullah was before me.
Yeah, but I gave you the microphone, darling. So please.
Okay, thank you.
And Abdullah is a very, very friendly, patient gentleman.
Yeah, I know. Hi, Pekka. I'm two quick questions, and I don't know if first I know I don't know if you have read the article in Yle written by some Finnish defense expert in explosives regarding the bridge, but he says that he thinks it was a truck bomb because of the footage, and also if it's not too political, since I'm Swedish, I'm wondering, and this question you don't have to answer if it's too political, and maybe Axel will say it's too political, but I will I'm curious, do you think if the Swedish Democrats get on two important ministry roles in our next government, do you think it will affect intelligence sharing between Finland and Sweden? Thank you very much, and Finland sak är vår. Thank you.
Tack så mycket, tack. First of all, the truck bomb. Yes, I know Mr. Major Turu very well. He's a best, one of the best, if not the best, expert in that field in Finnish Defence Forces. So if he says that, I believe him fully. What comes to come to the Swedish Democrats, I don't think that it's going to have a effect on the information intel sharing between each other. You know, there's a strong trust that our Swedish, dear Swedish neighbors do the right thing and select the people in the positions that we can and their neighbors can trust. You know, so there's trust till it's proven wrong. After that, there might be another decisions.
Okay, thank you very much.
And as to the truck bomb, we've discussed this here quite comprehensively with a variety of experts. I think we have to get your Finnish colleague here on the space and have a little panel discussion with the likes of our missile experts from the United States, as well as people such as Thomas Tyler. I think it will be interesting. But there you go. Before we go there, let's go to Abdullah.
Hello. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time. Just had a couple of quick questions, if I may. Just wanted to ask you, why do you think the Russian dictator chose this particular year? You know, some thinkers say that maybe he would have had a better chance if he had invaded Ukraine when Trump was in power, or, and you know, when the NATO alliance looked divided. And also, my second question also is, we had a guest on this platform a few days ago who said, you know, to paraphrase him, he said that the state of the German military is so bad that they might not even last 3 to 5 minutes in active battle. You know, I don't think he was bloviating. I just wanted to ask, what's going on in Germany and their military? Is their intelligence service this bad as well? Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. If I start with the second question, the German military. And I was in Afghanistan 2010 to 2011. It was hard fighting time, and we had 2 American and 2 German battalion task groups which we were using in operations. And the Germans fought in quite the difficult situations and hard fighting, sometimes surrounded without any support and anything. And they never gave up. They're good troops. Willing to take risks, willing to fight, no problem. I say that the Bundeswehr's problems are higher up. You know, it's the I'd say a bit too bureaucratic, bit too closely politically guided actions, so that the military is not free to do barely nothing without. Green light from politicians, which has created atmosphere where the military concentrates too much on sitting on the middle of their clothes and too little about, you know, operations and creating operational capabilities. They have good troops. I didn't have any problems with Germans. I had a lot of them as my subordinates, and as I said, half of our troops were Germans. Great guys, no problem. Maybe they just need a little bit change of attitude and change of how the politicians support the military, trust military more, and give them a little bit more mission tactics kind of tasking, so that they could move freely. And by the way, the Germans really know how to do the mission tactics. I saw that in Afghanistan, they're great in that. And they intel, as far as I see, they are in good in what they are doing. I don't have any negative things about German intel. And what was the first one about?
The first question was about why this year? Why did he choose this year?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I'd say that, you know, if Putin would have waited another 5 years, you know, Finnish defense forces would have faced a new 15% cut. NATO would have been disbanded more or less. We would all have been in coma. But luckily, he decided to start his aggression early enough that we still have time to repair all the damage that's been done last two decades in the defense capabilities in Europe. And I think that there are several reasons why he did it. I think that there were several windows of opportunity which were closing. One window of opportunity was his military strength. Russian, we've seen that Russian military is not that strong. Everybody thought it was stronger, but what they had was the better response times. They could start operations. They could mobilize from the active forces 150,000 guys in a couple of days, which was much more than NATO could do. And they also had a slight edge on certain technologies like hypersonic missiles compared to West. But this window was closing because the NATO was starting to make decisions about higher readiness. A lot of countries were starting to look to have a bigger military budget. Plus, United States put, if I remember right, something like $10 billion to develop better hypersonic weapons and means to defend against them. So that window of opportunity on military side was closing. Another window of opportunity was how long you can use this energy weapon you have, because the activities in Europe were heading to the renewable energy sources, and in 10 years' time, the possibility to blackmail Europe with energy would have been much less. And I think that the third window of opportunity was Putin himself. Life expectancy of a Russian man is 66.4 years, and he is now 70. Of course, he's got best medical treatment in the country, but still, he knows that he don't have too many active years left. Fourth window that was closing was Crimea's water reservoirs. Crimea was drying, and I think that they couldn't have lasted another summer without the water from Dnipro. And then, of course, he was looking at Europe, seeing that it seems divided. Western leaders seem weak. Biden's support was around 30%, and etc. So I think that all these affected that he thought that now it's time to attack. And luckily, he did it now and not later.
Thank you so much. Now I'll go back down with the commoners. Thanks.
I think, Pekka, what you just highlighted is quite interesting, because the strategic calculus and the situation he faced, the window was closing, and there was very little opportunity arising in future. Even if he might have been banking on different political machinations in the US, if that actually were the case, which I don't believe he can. But the economic strength of Russia has deteriorated. Its capacity to replenish the ranks has deteriorated. As you just rightly said, Crimea was drying out massively. And Ukraine, on the other hand, was succeeding economically. Ukraine was strengthening its society and was a clear success. Its IT industry had grown year by year from pretty much nothing, or very little, to $7 billion in overall GDP contribution. That is something Russia was unable to do. And by that means, he forced himself with his own kleptocracy into one corner. So I can only underline what you just said. If you don't mind, I would go to further. We had questions also from Antti, if I'm not mistaken, and then M, then Nina, then Mikko. Antti, please.
Thank you. So I would be very interested in your take in the how would you characterize the current status of Russian armored and mechanized forces? Because today we've seen clips that, or rather information suggesting that they are in the process of trying to somehow modify or modernize over like something like 800 T-62s. Thank you.
Well, I'd say that Russian armored corps sucks. It sucks in multiple levels. They have poor equipment. You know, the T-72 series, T-64, T-72, T-80, T-90. The basic construction is such that you can't make a good tank out of it. You know, you just can't. But they still try because that's the only thing they can do. They suck in training, the skill level of both the crews and skill levels of the commanders is bad. They don't know how to do the combined arms tactics. They send single tanks, single tank platoons, maybe companies to kill them one by one, and the tank troops because they don't know how to coordinate infantry, artillery, tanks, air defense, logistics engineers. They just don't seem to know how it. And it was silly that in Kherson, when the Ukrainians started the offensive a couple of weeks ago, there were complaints among the Russian mill blockers that it's unfair that the NATO has taught the Ukrainians to do the combined arms, that there's a 15 to 20 tanks and infantry, artillery and engineers, they're working together and they're making breakthrough. And I was thinking, like, what have you guys doing last freaking 30 years if you haven't been practicing that? So yes, they suck on that too. And plus, you can see they also suck on maintenance and upkeep of the vehicles. You know, the Russian tanks require more maintenance and service than the Western ones. And now that they've been in field 6 months on a row and haven't taken time to pull the tanks back and do proper maintenance, they have a lot of problems. You hear all the time reports that in three tank platoon, you have one tank which is actually functioning. One can drive but can't shoot, another one can shoot but can't drive, kind of thing. So yeah, I'm not too impressed about them.
Thank you so much for that, sir. Iske ja murra.
Iske ja murra.
Now you have to tell our friends outside of Finland what that means.
It's a slogan of the armored brigade, comes from our armor march, and it basically say, you know, hit and break.
Very well. Let's go to M.
Good evening, sir. Thank you so much for joining us again. On your previous appearance, or one of your previous appearances, you mentioned that your assessment was that the Russian Federation had enough police and military force to enforce public mobilization, should they go for that option. Now that they had gone for that option, the partial mobilization, and we've seen a couple hundred thousand military-age men flee the country, and we've seen them enforce the mobilization or the partial mobilization to a certain degree. How would you assess the level of success of this partial mobilization thus far, given everything that we know in open source domain?
Well, it seems that individual mobilization has gone much better, because it seems that there are more people who are military-age males who have left Russia than the Russian armed forces been able to recruit and mobilize for their forces. So we've seen they have had a lot of problems, and it's not that they haven't been able to collect as many people. I think that they have gotten, you know, majority. They have gotten over 200,000 probably, but still they haven't gotten fully the amount they have hoped to like to have. They haven't gotten the quality and the skill sets they claim they wanted to have. They you know, they've been tracking anybody, even a lot of people without any prior military training or education whatsoever. They haven't been able to create a good functioning training program for those troops. They seem to have a lot of problems in equipping these forces, even with personal equipment. You know, they have this crowdsourcing going on everywhere in Russia, trying to find some protective gear and night sights and other equipment for these forces, because the armed forces don't have anything. Instead, they report that they are missing 1.5 million uniforms somewhere. And they can't even equip them properly with heavy and unit equipment. You know, there's been reporting that tens of thousands of soldiers have gone to Belarus. You know, they just sent troops without any unit equipment, any heavy equipment. and they are just fully fulfilling the empty ranks in the depleted Russian battalions, or then are looking for the Belarus armed forces equipment, which is given to them. So it hasn't gone too well. And as I said, I really believe that they're going to do a second wave, if not in the end of the year, in the springtime. And if this didn't go this well, I don't think that the second one will go too well either.
As a follow-up, sir, would you assess that this partial mobilization, and indeed if there is a second wave, is just a stop-loss strategy rather than actually fielding a capable trained force or a capable reserve force that can achieve any advances on the battlefield?
I think that this is something that's coming out of necessity. They don't have anything else to do. They don't have anything else. You know, they don't have a reserve. In on paper, they had these over 20 reserve brigades. But now it turned out that, well, you don't have organized reserve for these brigades. You don't have equipment for these brigades. Therefore, you do what you can do. You call in people, give them poor training or no training at all, and send them to fill the holes in the ranks of the units fighting in Ukraine, because, you know, and you know that it's just cannon fodder, and these people will have terrible losses because of the poor training and equipment and leadership, but that's the only thing you can do. Then you do it because you're in a dictatorship and you don't care.
So
this brings us back, sorry, very briefly, doesn't this bring us back to the question we asked earlier and where we couldn't come to a conclusion quite yet as to what happens to those troops, and would another 50,000 KIA change the picture? Because if he manages to raise out of the 300,000 he has named to be raised, if he manages to raise actually 150, he may well lose a third of that up until the spring comes.
Well, I'd say that at least it's not necessary enough to create a popular rising against him, but I think that it will make the second wave of mobilization quite a challenging task, because now people would know what's really waiting for you there.
So more or less, and this is a bit of a dark humor, the punchline for this whole mobilization could be, we've run out, TM, trademark, please bear with us, and we're not getting anything done anyway, but we have to do it.
Yeah, more or less. And, you know, he just Putin is doing whatever desperate measures to continue this war. You know, he knows that he's, as the Ukrainians said, we've more or less dealt with the professional army. So he has to throw in the amateurs and trying to keep the war going, because he hopes that the winter will save him, that it will be a hard winter and the economies in Western Europe will crumble, and the political will to support Ukraine will go down. And he eventually would force Ukraine to negotiation table. Not going to happen.
All right. This is my last follow-up. And thank you so much for your patience and your insights, sir. As someone who was the former chief of a defense intelligence service, you are quite familiar with briefing, with managing morale, with briefing troops on their mission, defining the mission. What would you say to the recent videos emerging from quote-unquote Russian officers briefing the mobilized soldiers moving to the front line, that they are in a war against quote-unquote satanists, etc., etc., and all the political speech that they are using to quote-unquote motivate their mobilized troops to fight this fight, which is an illegal fight, of course. We all know that.
I'd say that these guys have terrible, terrible psychological skills and eye on the troops. You can see that these they really don't live with the troops, don't feel the pain the troops do. They just see them as a material that can be used. You know, they don't talk the language that the reservist would really understand, you know, listen and feel that we are cared for, and that even though it's a difficult situation, hey, at least I'll do whatever I can do to help you guys, and let's do this together. No, it's if I don't think that the feelings among the reservists after that kind of speech is not that great.
Thank you so much, sir. Off to you, Axel.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I tend to highlight this here on a regular basis, that there will come a moment when the disconnect between truth, reality on the one side, and the projection and these, how should we call this, satanic verses, will become so clear that not only the interspersed messages from some soldiers that, oh God, we are encircled, what have we done? And no, the Ukrainians are fully armed. Oh God, we can't survive here. At some point in time, this will set in. The question is only when.
Yeah.
We have two more questions. Sorry, please. Yes, of course.
Yeah, and I said that, you know, the one black swan which can raise is that if the losses in the front are too big, that we have another 1917 moment, that the guys on the front, the amateurs, the reservists there said, okay, this enough is enough. I'm not going to go there anymore. And that starts to spread. We'll see.
That's an interesting point. The first time we spoke on a phone, we discussed this. We talked about Tannenberg. And that we haven't seen mass surrenders, and we haven't seen those massive KIA lists yet, because it would completely demoralize the troops. What should Ukraine do in Kherson in order to, say, evoke those sentiments of Tannenberg?
Yeah, I'd say that if they would manage to get 10,000 prisoners, it would make great, great video material to spread all through the Russia, and that might have some effect.
That's a very good point. We have two more questions, if you don't mind, and I want to be mindful of your time, and we're very privileged that you're here. So, friend of the space, and you know her well, Nina.
Thank you, Axel, ja kiitos Pekka, että olet täällä taas. My question is, during these almost 8 months, I have somehow learned to become very black and white seeing this, how to end the war in Ukraine. And I don't see Putin giving up or any kind of coup coming. So the only way I can see it is the West giving everything what Ukraine needs. And we have talked about it, of course, a lot. So we have also talked about, is it possible to somehow influence the Russian regime, and I just don't see this happening. So my question would be that do you think that it would be possible that there would be a coup and that would end the war, or how do you see it? Thank you.
Well, yeah, problem with Mr. Putin is that he's an ex-KGB guy, so he knows how to assassinate people, and he also knows how not to be assassinated. So in the beginning of the war, there was news that there was news that the whole presidential staff had been changed, etc. So he's tough guy to kill, most probably. And that's one reason why Siloviks don't do it. But again, if there's a big enough threat towards the Siloviks, that their own existence is on and their position and their wealth and everything is on danger, they might think that, okay, it's worth trying. And that's why I've said that if Putin would try to use nuclear weapon, that might be one point where the people around him thinks that, okay, enough is enough, you know. Putin don't have anything to lose. He is ready to die in the nuclear war. I'm not, and nobody else around Putin is either. So then they might find the courage to do something. But below that, yes, I'd say that helping Ukraine in all possible means, and making it clear that Russia is not going to win. you know, pushing, starting the defense industry production in such level that that the Russians would see that, people around Putin would see that, yep, we are never going to win this war. Might be a way for them to start to find the courage to push Putin away. It's it takes time and unfortunately some time and effort, but most important thing is to the sooner they understand that they can't win and they are in danger of losing their own position and their own wealth, that's the way to make them to take the risk and push Putin away.
Isn't it interesting that essentially you just very consequentially derived the calculus which he faces, meaning he has no choice. He just may not recognize it quite yet. Because if he were to escalate, as many in the West constantly fear and portray and scaremonger and what, if he were to escalate before he can have the buttons pressed, he'd be removed and find a window frame maker. But on the other hand, he also cannot force a win.
Yeah. I think so. I think so that and that might be the one reason that maybe hopefully he understands that what would be consequences if he would try to do it. And therefore, he won't do it, or won't try to do it, because I don't think that he needs the military to do it, and I'm not sure that the military is ready for it, because the military understands the consequences better than anybody else.
Excellent point, Mikko. You had a question.
Pekka, question about Ousint. What is your thinking about Ousint? I think so, it's a kind of new world. And I googled you in one thing was like General Soleimani stuff, and it was like very confidential picture, and I was able to google what talks you had here with you. Just, just question. Because I saw you, somebody photoed you, I Google your docs, and it says, you know, the USA killing General Soleimani. So what do you think about Ousint?
What do I think about? Sorry, it's a bit bad line.
Yeah, sorry, I'm with Memke. So what do you think about open source intelligence? What do we can Google ourselves? And I saw one of picture of you. I just happened to Google it myself. Yeah. When you were in the active military and when you were chief of the intelligence, I see one of your documents which were classified, and it said about, you know, USA attack against General Soleimani or killing attack, and I saw that. And you know, I've been in the game before, and that was a little bit boring.
Well, I'd say that open source intelligence is a great resource. I said it in peacetime, you can get up to 80% of the intel you need through the open source intel. And it's, as we have seen during this ongoing war in Ukraine, that just using the open source intel, you can get a pretty good and accurate picture of what's happening and where, and mostly, especially if you have people who are a bit, let's say, not so aware about what Ousint can do, they can really reveal a lot more about themselves than they wish to. But the thing is with open source intel is that it's to be very useful, you need to have a capability to use massive amount of data go through, and nobody has that manpower. So artificial intelligence and machine learning is something in the future which will be needed in order to use all that data available and make some sense out of it. But as we have seen, this side is improving and developing very, very fast. But open source intel will never replace the old style intel. And more you go to actual war fighting, more you go to the field and operational level, tactical level, there you need seeking capabilities, you need image capabilities, you need human capabilities, etc. If nothing else, for targeting and open source intel sometimes works, but most of the times it's not the solution. So it's a very useful tool, very interesting tool for many people who want to know about the world. But and it's also a dangerous tool for those, dangerous towards those who don't understand that what open source intel and what the stuff you put in social media can actually, cause when people with bad intentions start to use that intel against you.
Yeah, that's a very good topic. And I think we should probably schedule another segment for this when we can talk about how to harden our systems and educate the population a little bit further as to what is necessary in that regard. Sorry, Nico?
Can I comment back?
Please.
Yeah, so I fully respect what Pekka is saying. Totally with Ukraine and Finland, but I was able to Google your documents via open source picture, and it was about you were general major for Finnish intelligence. You were briefing about the USA attack against General Soleimani. I was able to do that myself. And you don't need to comment to me about that, but I was a little bit surprised, what kind of citizen capability I have myself. Because I'm a little bit zoomed into that talk, and I'm criticizing you, but it's open source intelligence. It's probably like a new way of the life. I'm just saying that. Thanks,
Pekka.
I'm fully with our forces, so sorry.
Yeah, it just shows that you can bet that I haven't put any documents like that to internet. But if you have a briefing and somebody takes a picture without thinking it and shares it, then you have a problem.
There you go. I shall hope that we can schedule a segment on, as I said, hardening of our systems and how to prepare the general population, how everybody can learn a little bit about both operational security. What was it? Once was said, lose lips, sink ships. That has never changed.
Yes.
Well, I don't know how to say this, Pekka. It has been a privilege and a pleasure yet again. It has been absolutely clear. We even, I would have asked you at the very end, typically, whether you think, A, is there anything the Russian army and Putin can do? But we've answered that already. It's highly unlikely that there's any chance for them. And then I would have added, what do you think, how long it might take? And will they survive the winter? And maybe that is the final question.
Well, I'd say that Putin hopes that General Winter will help him, but I think that General Winter will bite his butt because his army is not prepared for the winter. And it will be total reversal from the Second World War when the Germans were suffering, the guys in the West were from the West were suffering because they didn't have a proper winter equipment and Russians did. And I think it will be a reversed role this winter. Plus, I don't think that West will give up as he hopes.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that, and thank you for that. Pekka, it has been a privilege, as I said. I shall hope that we can interest you again to come by and share your thoughts and your analysis with our space. And we may have a panel of the generals in a few weeks from now, if there is a possibility to gather Mick Ryan, yourself, and maybe General Hodges around the table and have a little look-see as to how you dissected them, because we all expect that the Ukrainians have one more ace up their sleeve in the coming weeks. So if we can solicit your confirmation that you would hopefully join us, if that is the opportunity, I would end on this. And thank you very much for being with us today. So,
yeah, thanks. Thank you. And surely I'm sure to participate if the time is just right. Bye.
That's excellent. Thank you so much. Right, kiitos. And everybody, please give a big hand to Pekka Tovari, who has kindly taken a lot of time yet again for all of us, and sincerely appreciated. Thank you.